Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. KSJE is supported by San Juan Regional Medical Center, a community-owned and operated hospital, here for you when you need us. From emergency care to routine checkups and screenings, caregivers are here and ready to provide the safe, high-quality care you need close to home. Online at sanjuanregional.com with the latest health information and resources to help you live life better here. It's 8 o'clock. It's Thursday morning, November 4th, 2021. Good morning, everyone. I'm Scott Bicklin. Thanks for tuning in to KSJE 90.9 FM, of course, over the air here in San Juan County, New Mexico. In Durango, Colorado, you can tune us in at 103.3 and everywhere else. Just go to KSJE.com or ask your smart speaker to play KSJE. That works as well. Welcome also to our viewers. This is a visual radio program. The video is streaming live today to the KSJE YouTube channel, our Facebook page, and our Twitter account. So we're glad that you are with us this morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us, because coming up in the next few moments, my guest, archaeologist Paul Reed, will be here. We'll be talking a little bit about the latest evidence about Vikings in North America and some of the science and technology behind that. That's coming up in the next few moments right here on KSJE. Then next hour, Mick Hess will take us roving with the arts. Mick is playing music from Bach on the program today. And don't forget, we invite you to connect with us on our Instagram page, in addition to Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. And if you're a podcast person, we invite you to subscribe for free to the KSJE podcast. The local programs that we produce here are all made into podcasts, and so you can take us with you and listen while you're doing other things like jogging or biking or running or whatever the case may be. But you can find KSJE podcasts on all the popular podcast platforms like iHeartRadio and Spotify and iTunes and Pandora and Podbean and much, much more. So subscribe and take us with you for sure. Weather forecast, 34 degrees and sunshine outside our studios here at San Juan College. We are expecting a mostly sunny day today with a high of 64 degrees in Farmington. Clear tonight and a low of 33, mostly sunny. A few degrees warmer tomorrow with a high of 67 on Friday. Sunshine and 71 on Saturday, 69 and sunny on Sunday, and maybe partly sunny skies with a high of 69 again on Monday. Overnight lows in the mid to upper 30s. Well, let me turn to my guest who is here with me this morning. Always great to have him on the program. Archaeologist Paul Reed is joining us from his home. Paul, good morning. Good to see you, and thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. Great to see you. Glad to be back.
Thank you very much. Always great to talk with you about, well, any topic really, but particularly this month. And we're talking a bit about this new technology that's been used to, I guess, kind of reconfirm the fact that that Vikings arrived on North American continent about 400 years before other Europeans, huh?
Right. We're branching out to what I might describe as a far eastern Chaco outlier.
Okay.
On the island of Newfoundland in what's now Canada.
Right. But that's okay.
Yeah.
I think we're okay to do that once in a while. So happy to do it and hear your take on this, because as I mentioned, it is interesting. And so as I asked you before we came on the air, we've always, I think, kind of known that there were a Viking presence in eastern Canada, what's now eastern Canada, and way northern North America. But this new technology kind of reconfirms that evidence. Is that what we're talking about?
Right, it does. And what we've had in the past, of course, are Viking sagas, basically, that were written way back from the 6th and 7th centuries and describe the Vikings coming down into England, Ireland, and then moving on to Iceland. And then description of moving to Greenland as well, and eventually down closer to, you know, the main body of North America. And then we've had really good relative dates from different sites, this one site in Newfoundland in particular. But what we really have now with the release of these latest data in this study is the classic smoking gun, absolute dates confirming not just a range, but an actual year of 1021 CE. So yeah, it's pretty exciting.
And the data then, or the technology that has kind of confirmed that actual year, and I looked at the article you sent me, and there's a lot of math involved, so it lost me like pretty quick. But this is kind of what we're talking about, right? Is that there's a scientific way to prove what we're saying.
Right, exactly. And, you know, as archaeologists, we always want the best possible dates, because what we rely on for chronology really grounds everything that we know. There's certainly many ways to talk about the past without having those dates, but once we have absolute dates, then things fall in line, and that, you know, that really helps ground us as we try to, as we've talked on the show before, really tell good stories about the past. And, you know, this particular set of data is a great data set, I would say. You know, there's 127 dates that were run with what we call the radiocarbon or C14 method. And then from those, they went on to tree ring based studies in order to say definitively it was 1021. And the particularly interesting connection to this is a cosmic anomaly that was found in, you know, most of the pieces of wood that were sampled that were then, you know, put through the radiocarbon dating process, and then they actually counted tree rings, which is how we do tree ring dating worldwide. And so that allows us to get down to this really narrow range. And this cosmic anomaly at 993 really kind of sets the calendar, if you will. And if we didn't have that, we didn't have the tree ring dates, we would still have a really tight archaeologically derived and radiocarbon derived range from 1019 to 1024. But again, it's the precision of coming down to it was 1021, and that date is detectable in three different trees sampled at this particular site. So yeah, that's kind of the nerdy bit, but
right. No, I'm following you.
And so this really exciting.
Yeah, this cosmic anomaly, talk to me a little bit about what that is, and that I guess then maybe gives folks in your line of work and others a baseline. When you find that evidence, then you kind of know that was that year that layer is being discovered, or that tree ring, or that whatever. Is that what we're saying?
Exactly. And it's really interesting, because this takes us back talking about, you know, cosmic events to the genesis of tree ring dating. An astronomer whose name was A.E. Douglas worked at the University of Arizona in the 19-teens and 20s, and he was interested in studying the sunspot cycles of the sun. And by looking at those, you know, through telescopes and other data that they had access to at the time, and then comparing them to trees, which, you know, he had a sense of when those trees dated, he was able to see that the production of the tree rings actually varied with some of these sunspot anomalies. Because of just the variation in the way cosmic radiation was hitting the planet, and then how trees responded in their normal growth cycles. So it's one of those historical accidents that he wasn't that interested in the trees themselves.
Right, right.
Know? And the tree ring dating, that was a tool to get him back to his astronomy. But because he was interested in trying to understand those events, he started talking to archaeologists, because he knew that, you know, the best sampling for ancient trees was going to come from archaeological sites and potentially things that had already been collected. But at that point, you know, this was the genesis of the tree ring lab that is still at the University of Arizona to this day, you know, almost 100 years later. And he basically talked to a lot of early archaeologists, Earl Morris, you know, who worked at Aztec and many other places. And we've talked about Earl on the show. So he said, you know, I need wood. So let's go find these. So he was looking for help with his studies, and he inadvertently, but very specifically and wonderfully from my perspective, helped archaeologists launch tree ring dating so that we could get better dates for when all these amazing sites that we study around the Southwest and really around the world, when those date. dated. So yeah, again, you know, you never know what the implications of your research might be, and how it's going to influence other things. So in this specific case, there was an identifiable cosmic radiation event that is marked in this at 993 and shows up in the growth rings of the trees and basically varies the growth of that specific ring in these different tree samples at 993 in a way that is detectable with visual means primarily. So then by dating the wood with C14 or radiocarbon, you know, that range, that somewhat larger range of 1019 to 1024 was derived, but all of the wood had the 993 date. So then it was simply a matter of counting rings, you know, the seven to get us to the year 1000 and then 21 additional rings to get us to 1021. So that's kind of the very two-scented version of this. Again, just the amazing convergence of these different methods and, you know, helping us better understand what happened in the past. And ultimately, again, hopefully describe a better narrative and get closer to the people who are actually, you know, doing these things.
Sure. Very true. Let me show a bit of the article, if I can, in just a moment here, from what we're talking about, which would be this article that you sent me from Explore. And it's kind of fascinating about these, they're saying wiggle matches. So explain that to me a little bit too, Paul Reed, with the carbon-14 data. That I can see as well.
Yeah, so there are, the wiggle is kind of the way that the C14 levels fluctuate through time.
I see it.
And ultimately, without getting super nerdy on it, that's what allows us to use radiocarbon dating to compare samples from the present to samples, you know, many, you know. I think radiocarbon dating can go back over 100,000 years ago, and that's because atmospheric concentrations of primarily C14 and C12 vary, and those can be compared to each other. So that gives us the wiggle in the curve, and they basically measure the concentrations that were trapped in these pieces of wood when they died. So at their death date, that basically sets the clock for carbon. And then, as with many other elements, you know, carbon decays through time, right?
Right.
So you measure those rates of decay, compare it to other data sets, and then you end up with, in this case, a very precise date. And then when we pull in the tree ring dates, we've laid over a different absolute method. So, yeah, I mean, this really is like, you know, the nerdy scientist's best
right.
dream, right? All the data come together, three different pieces of wood. They've identified two different species, which is also really important. So you've got balsam fir and then a juniper species that's a little different from ours, but is kind of in the juniper and cedar family. So that is even better confirmation with those, you know, those two different species. So, yeah.
Right. And we can see kind of the timeline there, too, at the very top for folks who are watching the video feed this morning of how they've zoomed in on that 1021, 1025 time span.
Right. And it's, you know, as we've talked in prior shows, this is the way that ideally what we do in science, whether social science or physical science, our earlier data build on the later ones. We get more samples. We put those through. And, you know, with this specific tie to this 993 event, to be able to sort of slice that out is going to allow some really precise dating in areas where we might not have the best tree ring chronologies. You know, in the Southwest, we are blessed, I would say, with amazing chronologies for different species, for juniper, for pinyon, for different higher elevation, different fir and spruce and ponderosa pine. But in other places around the world, those chronologies aren't as well understood because, you know, tree ring growth varies, of course, from spot to spot. So this really gives us the chance, you know, this is the larger we worldwide, to be able to connect things to this cosmic event if it can be found, you know, in some of the other samples that folks are looking at. So, yeah.
Very interesting. And the site that was found, Paul Reed, take us through, because again, as we talk about, and you mentioned earlier, that's a far eastern Chaco outlier, but certainly there's not any major structures that were found. This is, we're talking about maybe a campfire, a burnt wood, some other wood remnants and things along that line. Is that about the extent of what the archaeologists found at this site?
Yeah, I mean, I think we could call this, a sort of enhanced campsite,
mm-hmm.
right? So you've got wood, you've probably got some temporary wooden structures. You don't have a really dedicated Viking settlement with the long houses, and very little construction in stone has been found at this particular location. But people considered it, the Viking folks considered it a base camp from which they were wanting to expand. And, a good way to think about this is the best, if we go back in time a little into the 9th century, so kind of the early to mid 800s, we have Viking folks coming first to Iceland. So they possibly there before that, but that, we have pretty good dates in the middle 800s. We have Eric the Red saga from this time period, that is some documentary evidence that we can use. So basically the Vikings started coming down out of primarily Norway and Denmark. And they started to essentially raid England and Ireland. This was as early, I think the earliest date we've got there is in the 790s. And from there, they heard tell, I suppose, in the way we might describe it, of Iceland. So they moved on to Iceland and actually settled Iceland pretty substantially. And, folks have talked about this for a while, but if we compare Iceland and then Greenland further west, the names probably should be switched, because Iceland really is a green paradise with all the geothermal. It's a place where you can raise animals, you can farm. Greenland is much more like a frozen Iceland wasteland. But Greenland then gets settled, 100 years or so after Iceland, as, I guess, daring Viking explorers and their relatively small ships kept pushing further west.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in Greenland, say, in the 900s, and then ultimately coming down, further to the south and west in Newfoundland, on the edge of Labrador and Canada, like we knew in the late 900s. And this probably isn't the earliest date, so that is an important thing to say as well. And there's always a quest in the field of archaeology, and folks are interested in, the earliest this and this and this. This is the earliest, best, absolutely dated site. But it's likely that there are earlier sites going back into the 900s.
Gotcha.
And we may never absolutely be able to say this is the first time that this happened. Those are fairly tough events. But, it's just interesting, in my view, to see the Vikings move, east to west as they came across. And, the idea is that this was maybe never intended to be the most permanent settlement ever. But the evidence, it dates back into the 900s with relative dates and other things. We now have a 1021 solid absolute tree ring date. And then we have evidence of folks there all the way into the 1400s. So this is a long, at least 500 years of coming, island hopping, if we want to look at it that way, although we're looking at hundreds of miles and not dozens. And folks doing things, taking their animals, doing some herding, potentially trying to do a little farming, in those very short growing seasons, and trading with other groups. And, of course, the Vikings were raiders too, so we know some of that happened as well.
Right. And so they would have had interactions then with the Native Americans that were also here at that time. Is there any evidence of that, or what do we know about that?
Right. And that's one of the good questions that comes up immediately as well. Was this potentially just a native site and is not a European site? So they did a pretty careful assessment of the wood and found that you did have really good evidence of steel, and iron edge cuttings on the wood. So they weren't, the trees and the pieces of wood used weren't felled, and worked with stone tools. So that takes us, clearly into the realm of the Vikings at this time period. But there were other signs of chipped stone in the area. And, so they were interacting and trading. They were probably getting other resources, different types of shellfish, probably, walrus, seal, et cetera, trading for some food supplies with native folks who are in the area, who would be in sort of the generalized Inuit, sort of Arctic focused groups up there. So, interesting cultural interactions there. And just again, this, this Western push of Europeans, way before our Columbus event, in the late 15th century.
Right. Another kick to Columbus. that he gets over the years. But that's a pretty harsh climate, even 1,000 years ago, right? And so, for these folks to have who've come and try to establish any kind of a base or camp and secure themselves and make it through the winter and be able to have any kind of sustainability, that's also fairly amazing for this group of and of course the Vikings were pretty hardy folks themselves anyway, but I'm just saying it seems like a pretty interesting story of survival too in that area, right?
Right. And, you know, and it's certainly likely that other camps and areas were established on a more short-term way and that folks didn't make it, that they gave up, that they had a particularly harsh winter one year or a series of years and returned. So, yeah, I mean, as far as full-time permanent camps, you know, that's pretty unlikely with what we're seeing. So we probably have people, you know, bouncing down and around and doing it mostly in the nicer weather and, you know, and then potentially retreating to Iceland to overwinter in Iceland, which sounds funny.
Right.
But again, you know, with the geothermal in Iceland, actually a very nice spot.
You could do it, but you're still, how many miles away are you to go back to Iceland? That sounds like
it's a long trip. We're talking, I think, probably on the order of 1,100 or 1,150 miles-ish. And Greenland's, you know, a stopping off point. And there were some, I don't want to use the word permanent, but just more long-term settlements there.
Sure.
But yeah, not exactly like reprovisioning yourself, with a major city or town or anything.
Right. And I guess this goes maybe to the Viking culture about maybe they weren't necessarily looking to expand maybe their land holdings, but really looking to trade or raid or whatever, and then maybe head back to the home country, because we don't see these larger, I guess, settlements like maybe we saw when the Europeans came over to North America 500 years later.
Right. A real different move. I don't think we can describe the Viking movement as a deliberate attempt to colonize, to go and say, we're going to live over here. And of course, the Vikings were facing different upheaval of their own types in their own countries, but not really what we see later with European colonists, particularly the English, the Irish, Dutch and others who were leaving, you know, specific areas because of religious persecution or the inability to live the lives that they wanted to. You know, of course, we don't have to, on the other hand, totally put the Vikings into the realm of the mindless.
No, we've lost the connection to Paul Reed for a moment there, so let's see if we can get that back. Archaeologist Paul Reed, who is joining me this morning, and of course, technology, as it is, can be unpredictable from time to time. So let's see if we can get Paul back in just a moment and continue our conversation about this really fascinating research and study about the Vikings arriving in North America, of course.
In Ireland in the late 700s, in England, and even over to France. You know, the Normans ultimately were Vikings who joined up, settled in. Ireland, most of the cities in Ireland were founded by Vikings. Dublin, Waterford, Wexford, those all, Limerick, all have Viking roots. So eventually they stopped raiding and they settled down and, you know, sort of became absorbed to some extent into those other European groups. And then in Iceland, that's pretty much, you know, a Viking colony that didn't have a whole lot of other settlers from other parts of England. As you go further west, though, harder and harder to settle and colonize. And I think that's mostly environmental and the nature of the land there. Viking history is entangled with every part of, you know, northwest European history.
And, sure.
You know. So, and if you're English or Irish, you probably have Viking DNA. So.
Well, that's probably true. And I'm sorry to tell you, Paul, we lost probably the middle part of that answer because we lost your connection there for a few seconds while we got you back. But I'm sorry about that. But I guess my next question would be, is there, I guess, thoughts then in the archaeology world that there is probably more sites in this part of Canada and that there's more research going on or more exploration going on to try to see if there's any more evidence of some of this settlement from this same or adjacent time periods?
Yeah, there definitely are other sites, but I wouldn't describe them as abundant. You know, they're relatively few and far between, and with, you know, the different points of, you know, with climate change, sea, you know, the rise of sea level, and, you know, some of these sites have probably gone away just with the changes over the last several hundred years and that. And it really wasn't, you know, even this part of Newfoundland was never like the garden spot. You know, as you would have had to have gone further, and not that much further, but to what's now the U.S. East Coast for settlements. And so far, you know, well-dated sites there that are definitively Viking don't really exist. So, and there's certainly the possibility for finding those.
Right.
But, you know, as we've discussed, even in, you know, to having to bring it back to Chaco, there are probably undiscovered Chacoan settlements and sites here and there that people haven't yet found. But a lot of these areas have been looked at pretty closely. You know, ours is a field of discovery. So
right.
We never know what's around the next corner and what we might find that might modify our story, you know, in a little way or in a big way.
Very true. Very true. My guest this morning, archaeologist Paul Reed, is here, and he is talking a little bit with me about some of this work of technology of Viking sites in eastern Canada, and I guess using this new technology that has kind of been able to kind of confirm these exact year of this site. And so I guess the next question in the minutes we have remaining, Paul Reed, is, Can we, and by we I mean you and your colleagues, use this technology to maybe help you to maybe confirm more of what we know about these Chaco sites or other sites here in New Mexico, perhaps, to try to fine-tune some of the dating here?
I think in certain contexts, this could be really useful. One of the things that makes our dating of especially the really large Chacoan sites relatively easy and straightforward is they use lots and lots of wood, lots of high elevation wood. They treated the wood pretty carefully. So I mean, back in the day when they were building it, they were careful and they put it in these large sites, which many have survived. And, you know, fortunately, we've been able to date a lot of these sites, and we probably have the most tree ring dates from any single group of sites. Hard to talk about the world overall, but I would say in the West, Western U.S. from Chacoan sites, the site at Aztec, the two major components at Aztec East and West have produced something like 4,000 cutting dates of pieces of wood actually harvested and then put into the site. So our chronology there and at other Chacoan sites is pretty darn good. But for sites that have produced smaller quantities of wood that may not meet that minimum count, if we're going to do tree rings, we want between 25 and 50 rings. You know, more is always better, but at least that 25 ring minimum, depending upon what the specific chronology looks like for the area around Aztec or somewhere to the south. So for some of these areas where we haven't been able to have, you know, that tree ring chronology really well tied down, if we're in the late 900s and we have that 993 event, which is detectable in our tree ring samples, and at this point, you know, there's no idea essentially whether it is going to be visible in the tree rings in our area or if it's really specific to eastern Canada in that part of the world. But if we can detect that, then we can push the chronologies in these other areas, and that would be great because then we could get better dates and hopefully, again, get back to telling more interesting, more precise stories about the way people lived in the past.
Sure. And more evidence, again, as you mentioned, to prove what you're saying, and you've been teaching us that since we've been talking, I think, about the field of archaeology, and you bring up a discovery, and you're asked to prove it, and maybe add some new data to it, and prove it again, and that's kind of how this all works, and how the evolving stories and information that we have about these sites near and far come to pass, right? We get this information and then we find more evidence to add on to it that either proves what you've already said or maybe adds a new layer to it.
Right. And again, back to our fascination and heavy dependence on chronology. We love absolute dates because whatever we might say after we have those dates and begin to interpret a site and its chronology and how people lived, those dates ground us and then give us an anchor point from which we can then, you know, again, hopefully tell more precise, more interesting, better narratives ultimately about what happened in these places. You know, and for me, that's the payoff. The science is very important and gets us going, but ultimately we have to be able to take it to the next step as well, and to be able to translate it out of our archaeological archaeo speak, as we call it in jargon, and say, here's what's really interesting about this and why it might matter to someone in the public, you know?
Right.
So that connection is super important.
Indeed. And that's why I think, even though, again, we've kind of heard about this story of Vikings in North America for a while, but why this new evidence and new technology that's confirmed what we've known is so fascinating and has gotten picked up again by, I think, by a lot of folks in the media about it because of this new information.
Right, exactly. And it improves our storytelling ultimately. And, you know, I'm not sure all of my colleagues would agree with that as our primary purpose in the world, but I think that should be ultimately where we're going, to understand the past better through narratives that are accessible, not just to 100 of us at a conference, but across a much broader demographic of folks who are interested in this. You know, and as we've talked, the history that we share, and even ones that individual groups don't share, is part of this larger legacy for all of us. And ultimately that draws us together, I think, to have an understanding of that.
Very true. Well, Paul Reed, I'm sorry to say we are out of time, but as always, it's been fascinating, even talking about this. It isn't necessarily local, but it certainly is interesting to hear about, you know, what's been discovered and the technology that is kind of could be used locally as well. So there's definitely some local connections to our conversation this morning. So thank you once again.
Great, Scott. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. And we'll go further abroad next time.
Okay. All right. Let's see where we go. I'll look forward to it. Thank you, Paul. It's Paul Reed from Selman Ruins and Archaeology Southwest, my guest here on KSJE. KSJE is supported by the Farmington Civic Center, bringing a wide variety of live entertainment to the Four Corners. Country music, classic rock, and ballet, all on stage this fall. Also, on-stage theatrical performances of The Rocky Horror Show and the holiday classic A Christmas Carol. Find out more online at fmtn.org/shows. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.